Right now, though, we're going to be getting back into the text of 2 Kings. I listened to Stuart's recording of his class, the audio recording of it. He did a great job, and I told him that all that good work means is that he's going to be doing more teaching, because good work means you're asked to do more good work. And so he probably will fill in some. I tried to encourage him to do more, and we'll he'll see this recording too right now too, and we'll hassle him as well. But I think he did a great job, and I'm sure you profited from that class. Right now, though, let's bow our heads together in prayer. We'll begin our Bible study, and then after that, we'll be right into the text. Heavenly Father, we thank you for today. We thank you for the blessing that it is to have your word, to have your word understandable and readable, that we can grow and more clearly understand who you are, what your plan is for us, who the Son is and who the Spirit is. Help us to be good Bible students. Help us to be good followers of your Son, and forgive us of our sins. This is our prayer in his name. Amen. All right, as mentioned, we are in 2 Kings. We're looking at chapters 17 or 15 through 17 tonight. Stuart kind of introduced some of chapter 15 for us to getting all the way in the first few verses as part of his package, but we're going to go ahead and step right into the remainder of these two sections. And something's going to happen as we note these latter parts of 2 Kings. That is that the pacing is going to change in the way that the inspired collectors, editors, writers of the biblical text give it to us. You'll notice that up until about this part of this historical book of Kings, they had longer story sections, longer prose teaching sections about each of the various events in Kings. This section sees that length kind of decrease. And there's some obvious reasons for that. In these sections, you're going to find that the reign, the time period that these kings are in charge, just gets smaller and smaller. Some of the kings in this section are going to be in position for like only 7 months. And they're essentially written about by inspiration as essentially less valued or less important because in part of their spiritual rebellion, or that they are part of the offshoot factions that branch away from God's plan. Some of their names will include some of these big, you know, concepts. And right now, this is kind of the final 40 years of the Northern Kingdom. And you think about how dramatic this should be versus how it kind of dies in levels of a whisper. If we were to go back and remind ourselves, back when we read through the text of Numbers or the wilderness and the text of Joshua, those are pretty thrilling Bible stories, right? There's intrigue, there's espionage, there's conflict, and there's spiritual triumph. Because of the many reasons that God sends Israel into Canaan, they are all kind of focused on either fulfillment of prophecy, that God said he would do this, he will give them a land, that's where their nation will take root, but also they have a purpose there. Does anyone remember one of the purposes, like some of the purposes specific to why God is sending Israel to destroy the inhabitants of Canaan? Right, that's part of it, Bobby.
Because they had got so wicked.
Right, their wickedness corrupted the land. Even in specific, some of the giant populations are identified that maybe have a connection back to the Nephilim, all the way back in Genesis, early parts of the history of God's people that are recorded there. So there's a real conflict in the spiritual realm that's being addressed in the physical realm. That's a big deal, because that's part of that going on. And so that actually becomes the tension that goes from Joshua to Judges and beyond. Like this whole, hey, there's still some corruption left in the land. Not everything is taken like it should. The Israelites themselves don't really spread out as they should. And so all of that kind of creates a little bit of murkiness until we get to David. Saul pushes into David's reign in that regard, and they gather all this together. Well, from Saul to David to the wealth of Solomon, it just falls apart. Pieces of the kingdom gradually are nibbled away by the pagan outside and the pagan leaven inside the kingdom. To where now you have the division, and you get these kind of last pushes. And part of it is, how do we read it? Some failures in life exist because of chance. Like, the odds were not against, were not for you, and you know, on that day it rained on your fishing trip, and there's nothing you could do about it, or something like that. The author doesn't approach this record with this idea that these things just failed because it was unlucky. There's obviously a theological, a God knowledge level of judgment and justice being met out, because the rest of the prophets will inform us and tell us of God's bigger plans. By the way, I think we all remember this, but how do the prophets initially respond to what happens to Israel in these series of judgments that they'll go through? Three different kind of steps into captivity. What was the ideas of the Jeremiah and others as they are pulling Israel off into captivity? Joe?
What my takeaway from Jeremiah's prophecy to the Israelites was that they just strayed away from God. They were into worshiping, I call them false gods, but they were into worshiping Baal, to the extent that God's work, Jeremiah was, leave him alone. And by that time, God's plan was already in place for Nebuchadnezzar to just take them into the 70-year captivity.
Right, so part of it is a resolution of justice or consequence of their rebellion, their sin. Matthew?
One of the ideas that I think they harp on a few times is that how can you, they may be bad, but how can you let Syria or Babylon be the ones to take your people away?
Yeah, and you think about this. The purpose of Israel coming to the land was to cleanse the land because it had been corrupted. From the earthly standpoint, they're going around and saying, how can you let that corruption back in? Because in our biblical record of what happens when these foreign kings come in to sack the temple and to sack the heart of Jerusalem, is they just take it all. They take the innards of the temple, they crush the temple. It happens again later in the time of Jesus when the Roman armies come and do the same thing. This is holy ground. A concept that, to a degree, as Christians, we don't necessarily see the same way. Because you think about it, do we as followers of Jesus view physical earth the same way that Israel cared about the land of Israel?
No.
Not really.
We shouldn't.
We sometimes kind of struggle with it a little bit, but we really shouldn't. But we need to understand it. We need to acknowledge that that's part of what's going on here, and it drives what Matthew reminds us of in regards to, hey, how could it be? How could you use this awful, wicked people to punish our awful, wicked people? Isn't there another way? But remember, if we go back to Judges, and that's a great kind of proving ground for this concept, did God use wicked people to judge in the text of Judges? Oh yeah, like what's interesting about that text is God first used Israelites to bring judgment, and eventually he brought outsiders to bring judgment, and the book closes with Israelites basically tearing each other apart. like Israel against Israel in the end. So that kind of sets the table for what is not going to be a very pleasant section of the Bible. There are parts of the Old Testament that are just amazingly good, right? Well, unfortunately, we're not really reading in one of those sections. And so in very quick pace, you're going to see a lot of this play out. Beginning in chapter 15, which is kind of our earlier stuff of seeing this, I'll just make this quick side note as well. There's a good theory that a couple of commentators include in regards to how this is structured. This section right here of chapters 14, 15, 16 of 2 Kings is remarkably similar to the layout of 1 Kings 15 and 16, which have the same kind of layering of failure, if you will. Back in that 1 Kings book, first half of 1 Kings, Nadab was overthrown, Elah, Zimri, Ahab's house is overthrown. Now we're going to see Zechariah overthrown, Shallum overthrown, Pekahiah overthrown, and Pekah overthrown, and you kind of see those things play themselves out. So our first one again is Shallum of Israel. It shows up here around verse 13 of note. They rule over in the 39th year of Uzziah, Azariah of Judah, and this individual only rules for a single month. I think this is the second shortest reign in the Old Testament for one of the kings of northern, southern, or United Kingdoms. Zimri had the full 7 days. And so that's the shortest in the list. In non-biblical records, Assyrian records from this era, they refer to him as the son of a nobody. It's a phrase, an idiom that seems to indicate a pretender or a usurper. They didn't have a right to the rule that they grasp on. And they're killed in another coup, which is that violent takeover theme. We're going to probably see more than we really want to. Verse 17 shows us another, and this is Menahem of Israel. That's verses 17 through 22. The son of Gadi, and I'll note this, they ruled for 10 years. I think that is the first person to rule longer than 6 months since Jeroboam III. Anyone work for a company that had constant turnover of its leadership or kind of saw that in a community somewhere? Like every 6 months you got a new boss? Does that go well? Like have that level of like 6 months every week, 3 months later? You think about how this is for the kingdom. You go 6 weeks, you go a month, you go a year, some of them go a year and a half, some 5 years. Constant change in leadership. It'd be one thing if it was super peaceful. But none of these changes that are taking place are like, all right, you know, I've finished my job and I did everything I was supposed to do and now I'm going to retire and the next guy's coming in. They're essentially all some level of violent takeovers. This creates the conflict inside the communities that really allows rebellion to take place. Because if no one's truly in charge, then who actually rules? Everybody does. And how do they establish their rule? Power, might, conniving, purchasing it. What happens to the weakest people in that society? Slaves, they're oppressed, they're killed. If they have anything, it's taken. That is the context of these failed kingships in this time frame. Now, to have a long period of rulership kind of abates that and pushes it back. But what happens historically in this case is that, well, we'll think about it this way. If this had been the band of behavior during the reigns of David and Solomon, and we've got on one side the good stuff, and on this side the bad stuff, all right? And this is kind of how the scale goes. During David and Solomon, Israel moved towards the good stuff, right? They generally behaved well. As these new kings come in, and the slide kind of eases this way, it pushes this way. But then a good king comes and pushes it back. But it never gets back to where it was, right? And they're always inching it more and more and more and more. It's not the only way that history shows the fall of nations, but it certainly is a common theme in the decline of nations that morality precedes its fall. There's lots of historical documents to talk about how different nations go through their end. But in this particular case, the Bible records a lot of it for us. And it puts the weight of responsibility in different boxes as it goes forward. Sometimes it's the kings, sometimes it's the priests, sometimes it's the people, and sometimes it's all of them together. But they're all being pulled towards a further position away from God's design for them. And they're inching that way. And even with these long-living kings, very often they're not pulling it in the right direction. In this case, with Menahem, the text says, he does what is evil. It's important for us to acknowledge then that the length or tenure of a king's rule doesn't mean it's because they're doing a good thing. It may mean that they just are in power for whatever reason longer, and the suffering includes these outcomes. This is where the cycle of invasion takes place. From verses 17 all the way to like around verse 22 or so, we're going to see initial conflict come up. There's a reference in the large chunk of the end of this section where we're going to refer back to the book of Chronicles, which we'll see more detail when we go through Chronicles next. We'll go back to some of these stories a second time. Before we get into our next king, which starts in verse 23, what are some of your observations up to this point? Things that you read, things that you noted, or maybe important for us as we're kind of paying attention to what goes on in the scriptures here?
It seems that these kings start to rule one way or another. They become more violent in their actions.
Yeah, there is that. I'll notice, and I think this ties into one of Bobby's comments. Verse 20, Menahem extracted the money from Israel, that is, from all the wealthy men, 50 shekels of silver from every man in order to buy off the king of Assyria. Historically speaking, how long do these payoffs last for Israel? When you start thinking about it on a practical level, okay, so you pay off the first one, the next one comes in, do you have the money to pay him off? No. And now do you have the money to raise an army? No. So you're twice worse off than you were at the outset when resistance and trust in God could have averted calamity. I think there might be a lesson somewhere inside of that for all of us. From Menahem, we go to Pekahiah. He occurs in the 15th year of Azariah, king of Judah. He's the son of Menahem. In his case, he rules 2 years. So we got a few days, a month. Then we go to 10 years, 2 years. Really similar to Zechariah and Shalom. Nothing really identifying. He is struck down by his captain. So another coup enacted in regards to his demise. That brings us to Pekah. of Israel, now the son of Remaliah, serves as the ruler in the 52nd year of Azariah in Judah, and now is another king during the reign of this single southern king. So there's a lot that goes on in that, but you think about this. You're living there in the midst of this community. And in the southern kingdom, the king just keeps ruling, and maybe not perfect, but it's relatively peaceful by concerns. And in your space, chaos rules. That should be a point where we look at it and think, what is the lesson that the Israelite would learn? Because when we read the Bible, we're doing a couple of steps. The first thing we try to figure out is, what did it mean to them? Can we understand their world? And then how can we bring that to us? Because that's the second step of the process. So if you're living in the northern or the southern kingdom and you're seeing this all unfold, and these series of awful kings are around you, how do you kind of think that through as a 21st century disciple, thinking about followers of God and living in a world like ours, but not like ours? Any quick lessons that you see? I've got a couple on my list, but just curious what you guys read there. Yeah, like one of the most simple lessons and most important probably is our individual behavior matters for more than just us. It mattered. The king's leadership affected the nation. The priest's leadership affected all of Israel. Family leadership affected the households. And in some cases, historically in the biblical text, nations were saved on the basis of just a few faithful souls. And so there's a big impact on individual faithfulness in the course of nations. The balance to that is, at times, God uses a different method. He still condemns that nation. Sometimes the believers suffer inside the condemned nation, and sometimes the believers escape. But even those who suffer inside those nations, they don't suffer as one who has no hope. And so there's a picture there that we've got to kind of see, like, it repeats itself historically, where this is a normal interaction of God's people, the nations of men, even God's nation struggles with this. It's pointed out here in the text that he reigns, our Pekah of Israel, for 20 years. But we don't get a lot of detail, right? Pekah reigns in Israel for a 20-year spate of time, and we don't get a lot of information, right? No, but we also don't get a lot of praise or condemnation, just that it's a big chunk. I want to also make a little quick little note. Is that from this point forward, in the written record, and in the Assyrian records, and in some of the things from the prophets, we're going to get less information of the chronology of these individuals. Like, we're not going to get as many details. We have to do a little bit more guesswork to figure out when they reigned and how long they reigned. And we have to acknowledge one thing that's really important. The way in which Hebrew chronologies are structured doesn't lend itself to mathematical precision, like X number of years for the most part. A lot of times they shift into theological rankings and like rounding off and groupings for other purposes. So just recognize, kind of going forward, it gets actually a little bit more chaotic in this latter part of the King's book. Again, we have another invasion that comes in, attributed to Tiglath-Pileser. Captures a number of the northern cities: Abel Beth, Makkah, Ijon, Hanoah, Kadesh, Hazor, Gilead, Galilee, Naphtali. Captives are all pulled off into Assyria at this point. And this happens during the 20th year of Jotham, the son of Uzziah. And so we see a slight shifting kingship here at this point. And this northern section of Israel, what we consider northern Israel physically, is one that becomes central to the biblical story later, right? Because that's where Jesus does a lot of his preaching work, is in the northern sections of Israel. But at this point, these communities, these cities are being pulled off into ownership. And so physical remaining Israel gets smaller and smaller as the animal that surrounds them takes bites off of the big pie. And those bites are going to get bigger and bigger to all we're left with is a very small last piece of Jerusalem and its surrounding space that will be the southern kingdom at that point. This slow degradation will eventually bleed the livelihood of everything. Because inasmuch as they were separate kingdoms, they still had family and historic interactions with one another that helped their economies and their communities grow. It's also good to recognize that we can kind of visualize what some of these cities look like. And so most of like the historic cities we're talking about, let's say any of these northern cities, picture, if you will, about three streets out from the center of the downtown Noonan area. So if you went three streets one way and three streets the other way and then did the square the other way as well, that's the typical size of a city in this northern kingdom space, how much ground it would take up. We tend to think of cities in a little different ways, right? Do we consider Sonoy historically a big city? No. But its population is actually more equivalent to some of these cities being discussed. The large metropolitan centers that we're familiar with are just not present in Israel at this time. They're much, much less populous for all kinds of reasons, because most of the folks don't actually live in the cities. They're going to live out with their herds. They're going to be still slightly nomadic. Lots of small villages that surround these more fortified cities. And as was the common case in this time period, when these marauding armies came in, what do the people do in their villages? They all stream to the cities that had a fort or a fortress or numbers. And so when one of these foreign kings takes this entire city, they essentially have dominance of a region, because now there's nowhere for anyone to go hide. So they now own that space going forward and then go from city to city doing the same practice. And so that's that process of them taking over this part of the land. Any questions here as we're kind of hit 30 minutes in and we're not quite halfway through, so my schedule is going to not make us all the way through. That's fine. We'll be okay. You guys have any questions or thoughts on this first chapter, if you will? Steve?
You would think that Azariah reigned 52 years, and all these other kings of Israel would only reign a day, 6 months. You would think they would get the idea, hey, he reigned 52 years, he's doing what's right in the sight of the Lord. Maybe I need to change.
You would suspect that. I think they call that in detective work a clue. But here's another way to think about it too, like on a human side. New king comes in thinking they can be a better king. They believe they're a better king. The Bible tells us they're evil because their allegiance wasn't to God. That also tells us about the allegiance of the people underneath them. They had allied themselves no longer with God, but with their new king or another god, which is what Joe had mentioned at the beginning of the class. One of the lessons I think is super important for all of us is that that is very normal in the Bible. That people think that if they can get the right earthly king, everything will be okay. But the entire story of the Old Testament is none of the earthly kings were sufficient by themselves. None of them. Even the best of them are only successful because they partnered with God. We live in a nation right now that says constantly, we need a new king because the old king isn't good enough. And I don't care what you think the king should be doing, I can guarantee you, you probably don't like half of what he does. Right? I'm saying king as an accommodation for our president. And we don't like it. Is any of our earthly kings ever going to be good enough?
No.
Even if Les was magically elected king, he was our new president, he'd probably resign on the first day, to be fair. But even if he aligned himself with God, the kingdom has shifted into its focus. It's not an earthly kingdom anymore. I'd vote for Les in a heartbeat, but he's never going to run, I'm pretty sure. That would make my life so much easier in making those selections. Matthew?
That's why I would make the application today. It's important that we seek truth, because the nature of man is such that it's easier to lie to him than to convince him that he believed a lie. And that's the end of it.
Yeah.
Why it's so important that we seek the truth, because we want to believe the lie, but we don't want to believe that we've been fooled or something. And it makes it very difficult to change that. And when you start to get that, you get people in power, and you support that. You don't want to believe that you've been wrong. You just rather continue what's going on and live the life that you've become accustomed to and comfortable with, which I think the Lord illustrates. You should, not in a bad sense, but you shouldn't be comfortable in this life.
There should be a tension that exists between our comfort and how God wants us to be. Like, we should be being pulled out of our comfort, but we tend to pull towards our comfort, and there should be some tension there. I think you could probably go through history and lay it over the Bible and notice this, that for the most part, people maintain their power by convincing them, like Matthew has said, that if they're not in power, the bad things will happen. And they can fix the bad things. And I'm using really generic terms because it doesn't matter. Everyone gets a new list of bad things every year. Those kind of stressors on us then do impact our faithfulness. And they do impact our commitment to kingdom principles. And they most definitely, for Israel, led to its downfall. They were pulled by deception of individuals like Ahab and Jezebel and others, and good kings who submitted to foreign powers, thinking that this temporary fix would work, became less good kings. And they slowly slid underneath the boot of the nations around them. Jotham of Judah is now brought up to us here in verse 32. Verse 32 of chapter 15. It's the second year of Pekah, Remaliah of Israel, 25 years old when he begins to reign. Rule 16 years in Jerusalem is one way that you see this kind of read in the text. It seems like his mother, by the text here as well, his mother's name is Jerushua, the daughter of Zadok, and he does what is right in the eyes of the Lord according to all that his father Uzziah had done. So he's like his father Uzziah. He follows the standard practice of these kings, and he leaves the high places. He does rebuild the upper gatehouse, so he's fortifying physical structures around his rule. And he is going to eventually die and be replaced by his son Ahaz, because he dies around 40. Over the years, I remember when I was starting to read history more specifically, later high school, starting to preach, we always had this idea that lifespans were super short in earlier eras. But I learned that that's actually a math issue. Because they averaged lifespan across the entire generational groups of folks. And when you pull out the reality that in these earlier eras, child lifespans were super short, everybody else's lifespan gets to the biblical length. 70s and 80s become pretty common because people don't survive infancy and childhood at the rate they do now. And so that's why you have these rise in lifespans later down the road mathematically. So for him to die at 40 is a relatively early death for anyone in that era. Specifically in this case here. Because A, he seems to be doing a fairly good job as a king. Not a great job, but certainly not awful. In the middle, very mid, if you will, in his role as king. And unlike the kingdom to the north, as we refer to it, these stable kings bring good to the people. They bring peace of its kind, and they allow growth spiritually for some, and it gives us a hope of maybe they'll make that last step and take out those high places, or maybe there'll be a little bit more. So in this picture, we see some conflict take place as well as we get to Ahaz, because Ahaz will also be identified as ruling kind of like his father as well. Before I read, start talking about Ahaz, we've got about 9 or so minutes left, and I'll make sure. Any thoughts here on chapter 15? Because we're going to be in chapter 16 in just a second. Things that we haven't noted? I don't want to run over anyone's good ideas. So the answer historically is it's all of the above. There would have been some high places that would have been alternative worship sites to God. But archaeology, historical, and the prophets' writings suggest that these high places were also to the Asherah, the Baals, or the Baals of the pagan gods too. And so remember, occupancy of Israel isn't just Israelites at this point. You still have Canaanites who survived. You had the follower-ons that came down from Egypt with, or came up from Egypt with them, and so some of them are clearly pagan worship locations. And in the archaeological digs that take place around the edges of Israel, especially up in the mountains, it's pretty common for them to find remnants of worship sites. Some of them are most clearly referencing God. You'll see them using imagery that's very similar to the bull and calves that are very connected to Israel, and some are not. They're other gods. And so the answer is it's kind of all of the above. And God condemns both in the prophets' writings.
Do you think it was more like a communal established site and then you just go worship the God
that you believe? Well, it's like... In some cases, I think that was the case. Some of them, historically, were... It depended on who was in power in the region. So, for a while, they would be God-centric, Elohim-centric. Other times, the Asherah or the Baals would then rise in the prominence, and they would build at the same spot. So, in one of the historic sites in northern Israel, they dug down over this worship spire space. And as they dig down, they go through the history of the worship of Israel. And so you can find layers that are full of Asherah and then layers that are free of all that idolatry. And those are the times when you would kind of connect with David, Solomon periods. And you go deeper into the pagan history and it goes back to their pagan ritual space. And so it just kind of varies. Some of those sites are very much everybody. It's also like what you see in Judges where they have a town or a city idol. And so there's some of that too. It's a really not so much a pantheistic view because these are not gods that worked together. These are gods that were often very much in opposition to one another. And like it was in that region, our God is the strong God, would go fight this God over there who was the weak God. And they would have high places for worship. And some of those high places were dedicated to Elohim, to God, to Jehovah, to Yahweh. Some were not. And you kind of have to get really specific and then dig through the thing. It's like, okay, what about this little area here? What did they do? And you might have two communities or two towns that shared one high place. And that one would have been to a god, or sometimes two. There's some archaeological records that show columns, like we would think of columns, but they had three different gods on those columns. One of them has Jehovah on the base, and then two other pagan gods on top of it. And so they would share that worship site. That's a good question. And it's kind of complicated. I wish I had a very specific answer, but the answer is all the things. About a few minutes here. Let's do this. I want to go ahead and introduce Ahaz. I think it's probably good for us to at least begin this. Ahaz begins his rule in Judah. He is doing so in the 17th year of Pekah, son of Remaliah. He also is about 20 years, 5 years younger than his dad. And he rules 16 years, just like his father. He behaves far more like a northern king than the southern kings before him. You might read in the text later down the road. He offers his son as a burnt offering. He acts like all the nations that God had driven out in the end. And so this is really where we're going to see the southern kingdom pick up on the bad habits of the northern kingdom, which is the opposite of what Steve was suggesting. Hey, why didn't they figure that out? Because we forget that both of these peoples are forgetting that God is their king. They're in the gradual process of leaving God and chasing after the nations around them. So let's see here. Let's go into this last few minutes. Class will end in about 2 minutes. But in chapter 15 through the first part of chapter 16, what are some of your observations? Do you guys have any questions that you wish that you can get an answer to? And by the way, that doesn't mean we actually have answers to them. Like some questions, the Bible doesn't explain to us, but knowing that this is a question that we don't get an answer to is as useful as an answer at times, because you can set it aside. Say, we just don't know. Like we literally have no idea about that detail. Is there anything to like in here? Not much. There's not much good. Joe?
I've tried to understand the reign of this king that reigned for 50 years. That was kind of out of the tradition of the 40-year reign. Am I saying that correctly?
So the way Israelites and Hebrew writings treat a reign of a king is when they round it to 40, and often they do round it to 40, they're meaning that they believe that was a good king like David and like Solomon. When it's not 40, it means there was something wrong. And that wrongness may be leaving the high places. That wrongness may be like the northern kings. The wrongness could be any number of things. But they almost always, when you have either less or more than the number 40, which is their standard, this was a king like David and a king like Saul and a king like Solomon. Because even though we don't like Saul, they treated his reign as equivalent as a good, powerful king in the way they wrote it and the way they thought about it. So it really just means that there's things like that. When that happens, it's not so much how many years they reigned, but it's more about, okay, that means they need to look for something. There's something not right about that, because that's not how they would write about the reign of their king in that way. Much in the same way, if you saw someone was president for 7 years, you would know, hey, that something happened, because it doesn't work that way. It is a way to think about it. That's it for our class tonight. Really appreciate everyone's participation. We'll continue then in chapter 16 next Wednesday night. Thanks, everybody.